little bit on the back end of that. I actually got signed in this morning.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And your remark, Mr. McCracken, you had the same panel as yesterday.
I saw the same friendly faces as I peered through the door when I arrived. I'll try to save a few minutes. I know I'm not very successful in that, but I do want to be able to make a few comments and rebuttal to the...
Two minutes, then?
Please.
Yes, sir.
And if time comes for me to sit down before that, I'll try to do so. Once again, I'm Barry McCracken. I'm here on behalf of Tyrone Williams. This matter comes on appeal from the Norfolk Circuit Court. It's a single assignment of error, and it challenges the lack of jurisdiction of trial court. And a couple of things that I can say right up front. It's a fairly straightforward case. And one thing it doesn't involve, which we usually get into in venue arguments, is whether this was an inadvertence on the part of the Commonwealth. You know, they failed to ask the magic question. In this case, the indictment charged in a very straightforward manner, basically intimidation of a witness in a proceeding that was to be held in Norfolk Circuit Court the following day. It's brought under the 18-2460C because the offense was a serious felony because it was a felony domestic violence charge.
If this could have been tried in Norfolk had it been... If the indictment were broad enough to include the obstruction or impeding the administration of justice.
Well, I don't think that's true either. I mean, basically, and I addressed that in my response to the Attorney General's brief. Basically, remember, there are two different offenses under the statute. And I don't think, and we can talk about 5A18, I don't think it has any place in this case. So my trial defense attorney could not have articulated a clearer position, right? And remember, this wasn't done at the end of the government's case. This was done in advance. And as I said, it didn't really involve an inadvertence. It involved a basically fundamental misunderstanding of the law by the trial judge and the Commonwealth attorney that prosecuted the case. Basically, if you look at 460C, we know that it actually there are two separate offenses. They only allege one in this indictment, impedance of a witness or attempted impedance of a witness. Even if you could say that, hey, the same conduct's a violation of both prongs of that statute, which I don't believe it is, I think this court and the Virginia Supreme Court has said there are two different offenses, they're aimed at two different types of conduct. One is burning down the courthouse, bomb threat, breaking in the clerk's office, stealing evidence.
But it wouldn't be a question of, I mean, you're saying that it would be effectively a sufficiency argument, but it would clearly he could have been charged with that second.
They could have, and they might have venue. Then there would have been the proper answer would have been a motion to strike.
The venue issue would have been resolved.
Not really, because the problem is, remember, you got to look at statute. What does the statute basically prohibit, even on the second part? Attempted impeding of the administration of justice. It doesn't require an actual impedance of the administration of justice. It doesn't require the courthouse to get burned down. It doesn't require it to get emptied out. Anything that would have interfered with the process of the machinery, as long as it was an attempt. And even if you assume that somehow we could take the conduct of proven here and lump it in, as the AG has suggested, and lump it into that second prong of the statute, it was complete in Virginia Beach. The judge said, a crucial, what was the word that the judge used in his ruling? A crucial aspect, I think, was the crucial issue. Well, the problem is, it wasn't, none of the crucial issues were an element of either offense under 460C. They both basically prohibit attempts. The attempt, even if I disagree with the analysis, but just for the sake of argument, if you assume this was under the second prong of 466, it was complete in Virginia Beach. All the elements would have been complete in Virginia Beach because it's merely an attempt. It doesn't require an active, the completion. No impact has to take place in Norfolk to violate either section of that particular provision.
But if an impact were felt in Norfolk, if the consequences affected things in Norfolk, wouldn't that be sufficient to establish?
Not under our law, and I think that's why I said there's a fundamental misunderstanding by the trial judge here. Basically, we have a general venue statute, which allows that there are, you know, in it by its terms, it allows exceptions, which is special venue statutes. There are no special venue statutes applicable to this particular set of offenses. The other option is it a continuing offense? This is clearly not a continuing offense under either prong of 460C. I'm doing the second prong by argument. Clearly, the second prong of 460C was never before this trial court. This has always been, that's their proof, that's their allegation.
But the Attorney General's argument is that there was no argument made, that this should be considered only under the first portion of the statute.
Basically, if you read the opening statement of the trial defense attorney, he basically said, look, Judge, this statute has two parts. And the allegation here, and when you say the alleged conduct, I think the defendant's alleged conduct. And I know all of you have worn those black robes for a long time. Judge Fulton certainly has, and he has to, he knows the allegation. Where do you look when you're talking? We haven't even put any evidence on at this point in time. Where do you look when you're talking about the alleged conduct? It's not hidden under a bushel basket somewhere. It's the indictment. It's sitting right there in front of him. That's the only allegation there is. I mean, I'm going to try to do it in 15 minutes.
Did the trial attorney's attack on the litigation proceed on the wording of the indictment or the facts and circumstances supporting a theory of violation under the statute as a whole?
Well, when you say did he proceed, when he made his venue charge, he started off by saying the alleged conduct, which is by definition the indictment, is the first prong of the statute. That was his fundamental premise. That was his opening line to the judge in doing the pretrial motion. Keep in mind, normally you don't get to do these motions until the end after the Commonwealth's presented its case because it's a factual, venue by definition is a fact-based inquiry. The reason this thing went forward kind of the way it did is the Commonwealth conceded that one thing in the indictment that was wrong was that it said in Norfolk. And of course, none of the conduct occurred in Norfolk. It all occurred in Virginia Beach. The Commonwealth conceded that in the pretrial motion. Remember, the motion was renewed, too, and to close the Commonwealth's case. So the evidence was in that.
The underlying conduct, I think everybody can agree, occurred outside of Norfolk. But as I understand the Commonwealth's argument in this case, the attempt was to impact the justice in Norfolk. So therefore, while the attempt occurred outside of the confines of Norfolk, it undermined the Norfolk process.
I don't dispute that, but that's not an element of the offense. And if the legislature intended Norfolk, because it got impacted by this type of conduct, to have venue, all it had to do was put a special venue statute in, but it doesn't.
Mr. McCracken?
Yes, sir.
If this case had been charged under the second portion, the obstruct or impede administration of justice, wouldn't a person's threats to a witness to persuade that witness not to honor a lawful subpoena be an attempt to obstruct or impede the administration?
Not under the jurisdiction, not under the past precedent of this court and the Virginia Supreme Court.
Why?
Because they're defined as two separate offenses.
I understand. I'm speaking only to the second portion. If you deliberately prevent a witness from attending court when there's a lawful subpoena outstanding, it seems to me that's an attempt to obstruct the administration of justice.
I think it probably would be if we were writing on a blank slate, but you're not. Basically, both Garcia, which was based on prior precedent of this court, and Washington, which adopted Garcia's at least analysis, insofar as the fact that the statute precludes two different types of behavior. And I guess, and there's a nice Latin term. I can't pronounce English very well, so I'm not going to try to throw in any Latin here. But basically, when the legislature makes a specific conduct and makes it a specific prescription, which it has done here, a more general statement doesn't include that conduct. Otherwise, to follow that analysis would say that basically there's, and I think that's fundamentally where the trial judge went astray, is assumed that that statute really prescribes any number of different ways of obstructing justice, and they could all be brought under the second prong of the statute, and that's not what this court and the Virginia Supreme Court has said is appropriate. I didn't make the law. I'm just trying to get the court to follow it. The other aspect, again, I'll go back to it simply because the analysis, we always have to be mindful. You know, Kelso and Spiker are two cases. One, if I give them back, I apologize. Spiker's this court's decision. Kelso is the Virginia Supreme Court decision. Kelso, basically, both of them, you know, they're different fact scenarios, but both of them found that venue was appropriate because different elements occurred in two different jurisdictions. One was a communication of a solicitation, and this court found that communication of a solicitation required both the sending and the receiving. The sending happened in one jurisdiction, the receiving happened in another. And they said, you know, multiple elements, both required. Same thing in Kelso, is getting a juvenile to distribute drugs. The act to get him to get involved in the transaction occurred in one county in Northern Virginia, our city, and the actual act of the juvenile distributing drugs happened in another. And they, you know, because there were two different elements, both required, either jurisdiction's fine. We don't have that. I mean, even under the second prong, even if, you know, like I said, if you set aside the actual facts and the allegations and everything else, and just look at what the statute prohibits. It prohibits an attempt. The attempt was consummated completely in Virginia Beach. Even if you assume that your analysis is correct and it could be, you know, it could be perceived as a violation of the second prong of the statute, I think that's contrary to our jurisprudence. But be that as it may, even then, under that analysis, it's the attempt that's prescribed. It's not the completed act. So it doesn't matter that, you know, there is no element required to occur in Norfolk. And I understand, you know, remember, if this was a contempt of court, then all right. But this is not an attempt. This is not a contempt of court. It doesn't require an impact on the court. It requires an attempt to either interfere with a witness, a police officer, judge, clerk, or to otherwise impede the administration of justice. It's an attempt, and it's complete when the step, the first, you know, we've done this before about attempts, when that act that constitutes a step toward a consummation offense is committed with the requisite intent, we've got an attempt.
And so you're saying that if let's take the situation to its absurd, sometimes that's how I best understand things. If you have a case that's pending in the Norfolk Circuit Court, and you have a witness who lives in Ohio, okay, and through correct process, that witness is brought from Ohio, is arranged to be brought from Ohio to participate in the case in Norfolk. If some individual, say a gang of thugs, goes to Ohio and intimidates this witness or attempts to intimidate this witness from testifying in Norfolk, Norfolk really couldn't do anything about it.
I'm not going to say that. And Judge, I think when you say, you know, I don't think that's absurd. We border, as you sit here, you're like 8 miles from North Carolina, so it could very easily be down in Moyocket. That's not a preposterous situation, but we're not dealing with state lines here. And I you know, when you try to take this issue and move it with a state line in the middle, we got a different set of parameters. What we're talking about here is the venue of a court in Virginia, territorial jurisdiction, to try a particular case. And crucial issues are not what the legislature and this court and the Virginia Supreme Court has said what defines those issues. What defines it is where the elements happen. And you could even go further when you really look at case law. It's not just every element, but it's every act constituting a crime, not necessarily every element, but that's not presented in this case, so we don't have to have that discussion.
You're in your rebuttal time if you check.
Well, I'll try to sit down in a minute. Basically, I think I've addressed most of the concerns already, but again, to suggest that Norfolk has a greater interest in this, Virginia Beach is going to protect its citizens from being intimidated, regardless of where they're going to be witnesses. And they're also going to uphold the administration of justice, wherever that might happen in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So to suggest that somehow Norfolk has a greater interest in this, I think is a bogus argument. Certainly the argument that 5A18 applies in this case, you don't have to read anything but first paragraph of the argument by the trial defense counsel to see that 5A18 has no place in this decision. I will sit down and keep that 47 seconds.
All right, thank you, sir. Mr. Katz.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. And despite Mr. McCracken's assertion that 5A18 has no role in this court's analysis, I'd like to begin with the assignment of error and talk specifically about the issues that are before this court today. And I think the court can be guided by page 24 of the joint appendix, because that is where the issue is presented to the trial judge. And I would submit that the issue is not presented to the trial judge, and I believe this gets to your question, Judge Alton. It is not presented in the form of, well, Your Honor, this form of indictment prevents you from considering 460C under an obstruction to the administration of justice. It's simply an argument about what the evidence means. And the argument from counsel is, well, under this evidence, he's at most in jeopardy of a violation of 460C that would involve the intimidation of a witness. It's not, Judge, you can't even consider obstruction of the administration of justice.
Well, Mr. Katz, in the motion to dismiss that was filed, the third allegation in that motion states all the defendant's acts with respect to this indictment were performed in the city of Virginia Beach. Why doesn't that bring to the court's attention that the language in the indictment is relevant to the determination of venue?
Well, I would submit that at the time the court is considering the argument, notwithstanding the motion, the court is not alerted to the fact that it may not consider anything else. And if we are going to apply 5A18 and require the trial court to meaningfully rule on it, I would submit that more is necessary than simply asserting under the indictment the only thing implicated would be in the city of Virginia Beach. And frankly, that doesn't specifically identify the issue for the court to rule meaningfully. It doesn't say, well, Judge, you know, you're limited in only considering 460C as it relates to the impeding of a witness. And if I may, Judge Petty, your question with respect to circumstances in which a witness is prevailed upon to not appear. I know counsel responded and said, well, that's at odds with the jurisprudence, but I would submit that the jurisprudence simply suggests there are two ways to violate 460C. And meaningfully, your example takes out of it the threats of bodily harm or force. And it wouldn't be difficult to manipulate the facts of this case, but rather than threatening a witness, he prevails upon whatever romantic attachment she might still have for him and say, look, if you really love me, you won't come. And I would submit that that would clearly be you're attempting to obstruct justice by the
administration. Well, I think Mr. McCracken's argument is that if the General Assembly must have meant the second portion of that statute to mean something different than the first portion of the statute, otherwise it would be redundant.
And I think it does. And it's not difficult to conceive of an example where you can seek someone not to appear in court without using threats of harm or bodily force by some other means. And in so doing,
if you love me, you won't come to court.
Exactly. And so it is not the same in every instance. I think
that's not the facts of this case. This is clearly a threat by violence, a threat of violence.
And my position is, even though these specific facts overlap in the two, it's not necessary that they're always the same. In the abstract, we can conceive of eventualities in which they are different, and I think your example does that, where you keep a witness away, not by harm, not by threats of harm or bodily force, but by some other means. Or your example, for instance, if you know the operation of the airplane keeps the witness away, if you somehow are able to keep the air crew from bringing the witness to trial, you're not using threats of harm or bodily force, but you're still obstructing justice and the administration of justice. So I would submit that the assignment of error, A, has not challenged the sufficiency of the evidence underlying the administration of justice. There's no assignment of error that says the evidence adduced at trial was not sufficient to support it under that theory of 460C. That's not an issue before this court.
You know, it's kind of like, your argument is kind of like, because in the venue motion, the defendant didn't specifically limit it to the charge of robbery in the indictment, that possibly larceny could have been valid, and therefore venue is valid. I mean, the indictment is the charging document. That's what brings us all together. And everyone has got to understand that their argument is predicated on the offense charged in the indictment, not on some other offense that might have been charged.
And I would simply respond, Your Honor, we are in a unique circumstances in which you have one statute that may be violated in two ways. And the indictment is merely to provide notice to the part. And it's evident from the transcript that clearly the defendant was aware that there were two ways this could be violated. And looking at this evidence, the defendant said, well, I think I'm most in jeopardy of this first way, and let me talk to you about that. But there's no argument that says, well, I'm surprised here today. You can't put me in jeopardy of this administration of justice. I had no notice of that. And that's clearly not the case.
But that's, your argument is, because someone, I mean, 18.2-248 criminalizes the sell, distribute, or possess with intent to distribute. And your argument is if someone is indicted for actually selling drugs or distributing drugs, and that's the charging document, that you could somehow come in and argue possession with intent to distribute when you're talking about venue. I'm just not sure that's true, because that's not what's before the court.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I think I would characterize my position as saying you might have a legitimate argument about what this indictment criminalizes, but that's not your assignment of error. Your assignment of error is this court was without jurisdiction to try it. And my assertion at this point before this appellate board is, you know, we can assign error to the sufficiency of the evidence of administration of justice, the obstruction of justice. We could have assigned error to the form of the indictment and what it was sufficient to put the defendant in jeopardy of. But that's not the assignment of error before you today. The assignment of error before you today is that this court lacked territorial jurisdiction to try this case. And I would submit that there is an independent basis of affirmance to say, no, this court had adequate jurisdiction if the issue...
Well, it's not jurisdiction. It's venue.
Your Honor, I'm going off the language of the assignment.
Assignment of error, trial court error in finding that it had venue over the offense.
The use of the term territorial jurisdiction, which has been sort of contaminated in the jurisprudence that's out there, using jurisdiction in the context of a venue case.
And I apologize for any confusion. I don't mean to suggest it's otherwise.
But every time we talk about jurisdiction, we get ourselves in trouble.
So the assignment of error attacks venue. It doesn't attack the form of the indictment. It doesn't attack the sufficiency of the evidence for obstruction of justice under administration of justice.
But it specifically refers, finding it had venue over the offense. That can only be the offense charged in the indictment.
Well, and I'm certainly cognizant of the argument being made. I'm cognizant of the headwinds against which I'm swimming. I would submit that if you agree that the issue was properly before the court, and that the trial court didn't conceive of the challenge to the form of the indictment, then there's an independent, adequate basis for affirmance. If the court finds that the motion was sufficient to put that issue in play, and that the trial court was limited to impeding a witness by threats of force under the first part of the sentence, then I would agree that you can't accept my argument. If that issue was before the trial court, if the trial court was limited in that way, then my argument does not prevail.
That the acts of intimidation all took place in Virginia Beach is not an issue there.
No, I can't argue that the threats of harm or bodily force occurred in the city of Raleigh. My argument is that if we are talking about obstruction to the administration of justice, that bleeds over into two jurisdictions, and under Kelsen, it's certainly appropriate to try that case in the city.
But the indictment does not use that language.
And that would get to my argument that we don't care about the indictment because that's not been put in issue.
The remedy here, I take it, would be simply to remand for a new trial.
Absolutely.
I think that's a relief requested.
Absolutely. With that, I'm happy to answer any additional questions if anyone has. Thank you. I would ask that you for
me. Thank you, sir. Remaining seconds, Mr. McCracken?
You know, and I heard what sounded like a concession. I think I'm going to allow you to dwell on that. I'll have to simply say this. Since I got 36 seconds, I might as well rail against something that always has been annoying. You know, basically what the AG is saying is we lost this one, but let's see if we can somehow snatch victory by some type of procedural default. The point I was going to make, and I'll do it in the last 20 seconds and 15 minutes, the trial defense attorney did in two paragraphs laid out exactly what the case law was, what the argument was. He had a very precise written motion, and he outlined that he did an analysis for the trial judge that was spot on. This issue was clearly preserved. It's clearly preserved in the assignment of error, and I'd ask you to do what we requested in the in our petition and now in our brief. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. That will complete the docket. We'll come down and greet.